Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, nurses with substance use disorders are asking for more protections.
If they have received help and they check yes, that triggers a disciplinary process with the state nursing board.
Plus, a local deaf doula explains her role.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Advocates in Georgia say that nurses who report receiving treatment for a substance use disorder put their licenses and their livelihoods in jeopardy. In a December episode of the Georgia Health Report, HealthBeat Atlanta's Rebecca Grapevine sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss alternatives to the current system, an issue which may come up in this year's legislative session. Here's their conversation.
All right, so first of all, how widespread are substance use disorders, or what we might call substance addictions, in the nursing profession in Georgia?
I looked into this, and there's not great data for Georgia, but what I can tell you is this. Nationwide, nurses face substance use problems at about the same rates as the general population. Here in Georgia, I couldn't get a hard number on the number of nurses who struggle with these issues. But what I can tell you is there are between 200 and 250 nurses in a Georgia Nursing Association program for nurses dealing with these issues at any one time.
For those nurses who do have a substance use disorder, how does asking for help currently put their careers at risk?
So here in Georgia, nurses have to renew their licenses every few years. And without that license, you can't practice as a nurse. When nurses go to renew their license, they have to indicate if they've received any treatment for substance use issues within the past 5 years. And if they have received help and they check yes, that triggers a disciplinary process with the state nursing board. You know, the nurse typically has to undergo this process where they get an order that sets out the conditions under which they can return to work. You know, they have to get sober, they have to get ongoing peer support, they have to undergo routine testing for drugs and alcohol. And this typically lasts for a period of about 5 years. This is also a public process, so nurses can feel embarrassed that their name and license number is out there and labeled with this issue.
But can it be argued that the current process actually helps protect the public?
Yes. Every expert I spoke to and every nurse I spoke to said their primary goal is to protect the public and make sure that nurses are providing top quality care, you know, that nurses are healthy and that their patients are healthy too. The nursing leaders I spoke to said Georgia's system discourages nurses from getting the help they need because they have to get this public order from the nursing board, and that can stop them from working and cause issues for them getting work down the line. They said people are delaying getting treatment early before they get to a crisis point where they really might harm a patient or do something else unwise, like drive drunk. I spoke to one peer recovery coach here, and he told me they're generally terrified to get help. They don't want to lose their licenses or their jobs.
So what kind of response are advocates asking for instead?
Yeah, advocates want Georgia to create what they call an alternative to discipline program that would allow nurses to get treatment without losing their license. There would still be supervision and treatment for the nurse, but his or her license would not be put at risk as long as they meet the requirements. And this process would also be private, not public, alleviating that embarrassment factor that comes in the way of folks getting help.
All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you, Emma.
Rebecca Grapevine is a reporter with HealthBeat in Atlanta. Her interview was originally broadcast in December. Sarah Moseri is a Northeast Georgia native and University of Georgia alum. She recently released a book exploring contemporary labor relations called Trust Fall: How Workplace Relationships Fail Us. She sat down in November with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss the book, which was mostly written in Athens. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell us a little bit, in broad strokes, what the general argument of the book is?
Let me take a step back and talk about the motivations for the book. So at the time and now, there was a lot of concern about kind of the decline of trust in society. And you know, you see that in the public discourse, you see that in bumper stickers that try to provoke, you see it in the tension in family holiday dinners. But what was really interesting to me as a researcher was looking and seeing that the workplace seemed like this oasis of trust. According to national surveys, it was saying like about 80% of people trusted their managers. And that was true in 2009, and it's true in 2022. And so I felt like this was kind of a juicy puzzle that you couldn't really understand just looking at the quantitative data. So I needed to get into these different workplaces. So I spent over a year and a half in different workplaces. I was in a restaurant for about 7 months. I was in a marketing firm for about 3 months. I was in a tech startup for about 3 months. And then I hung around with Uber and Lyft drivers for another several months. Basically, the book argues that trust at work isn't always the virtue that we make it out to be. At its heart, trust requires vulnerability. And so the book asks, why are we celebrating vulnerability at workplaces that don't really do that much to protect the people who are working for them?
So is it sort of like a worker sort of exposes a vulnerable side of themselves and then potentially the workplace can take advantage of that?
Basically, it happens, and I describe it in the stories in the book, but it kind of happens in all these different ways. You know, when everybody comes together amid a workplace crisis, which the way work is organized today, we typically have crises every week. You're kind of always putting out fires, whether that's the rush at the restaurant or big client deadline at, you know, a professional office. But when everybody kind of comes together and gets in the trenches, that feels really powerful and really good, and you feel this sense of kind of camaraderie. But actually, it's usually you're not paid for that extra labor or that extra intensity. And so it's actually employers that are benefiting off of those relationships that you're making. But it's also the vulnerability that you are, like the, a lot of people stay at workplaces a lot longer than maybe is serving them because they are loyal to either a manager or their coworkers. And that is sometimes getting betrayed along the way.
It's interesting because the places you went kind of runs the gamut of sectors of the economy. I noticed manufacturing was not present. Can you talk a little bit about like how you decided where to go?
Yeah, absolutely. And your point is such a good one. And it reflects the changing dynamics of our economy. So whereas manufacturing used to make up a huge proportion of our economy, we're absolutely in the service economy now. And so all of my sites did focus on the service economy. And I wanted to get this cross-section of kind of more quote-unquote professional jobs, typically jobs that require a college degree, and then those interactive service jobs, those that didn't necessarily require a college degree. And so that's what led me to the marketing firm and the restaurant at first. But each of those are very old industries. And so I also wanted to understand, you know, there's been a lot of technology innovations. There's a lot of that kind of disperse people more geographically and mean that we're mediated through technology a lot more. So I wanted to look at these emerging industries as well. And that's what led me to the tech startup and to the Uber and Lyft drivers.
Does your book make any recommendations for both managers and workers?
In the U.S., work takes up so much space in our lives that it can kind of feel like a family, and it makes it easy to forget why we're there, which is to earn a living. And so I think, you know, we tend to celebrate those moments of being in the trenches together. We tend to want to be a good teammate, to not let our team members down. And I think my book tries to help people bring awareness to that. So for workers, it just kind of names those moments that maybe feel a little off, but you don't know how to call it out. And for HR professionals and for managers and employers, it really helps them to look at that banner of trust and say, what's going on under the hood and how can we actually make trust work for everybody? And I think that that's important at the workplace level. Now, at a policy level, one of the reasons trust is so important in U.S. workplaces is because we don't have very strong employment protections. We don't have strong unions. And so we're almost left to trust one another. And that puts a lot of weight on our workplace relationships. So there's also recommendations for policymakers about, you know, raising the minimum wage, creating more accountability structures in the workplace.
Well, Sarah Mosseri, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Sarah Mosseri is an Athens resident and author of recently published book, Trust Fall: How Workplace Relationships Fail Us. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
Here Now brings you the latest news from around the country.
I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them.
Seems to me that people are being responsible, and yet it keeps spreading.
I've been door knocking and making phone calls and working in offices. I'm willing to do anything for this man.
Hear the latest news as it develops on the next Here and Now from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Death can be difficult to discuss, but that's just what local end-of-life doula Jessica Dukes wants people to do more often. She organizes a monthly destigmatizing discussion at Authentic Brewery with the nationwide movement Death Over Drafts. Last October, Dukes sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer, who was curious about what exactly death doulas do. Here's their conversation.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you to assisting families as they are with a loved one who's in their final days?
Throughout my entire childhood, I experienced losses of family members or friends or animals. And so conversations about death and dying were pretty common in my household. And it was never a taboo thing to talk about grief or being sad about missing somebody. And so I've just carried that into my adult life. And in 2015, I was living in Colorado with my husband, and I was reading an article about end-of-life doulas and how they've been around for a really long time, but that there was a movement for destigmatizing talk about death and to kind of bring it back to a community where you are being taken care of in your community, a little less business side of death and dying and a little more community-based. And so for the past 10 years, I've just kind of learned new ways that doulas can support people in their end-of-life journeys and also their loved ones and their communities around them.
You've practiced and been in the movement of destigmatizing death it sounds like a couple different states. Have you noticed that there are any sort of beliefs around death and dying that you would like to see change to kind of reduce suffering?
Living in Georgia is my first southern state that I've ever lived in. And so I would say it's a little more tight-lipped here. I think the traditional idea of like what your happens to your body when you die, and it's like you set it up with the funeral home and you do X, Y, and Z. It's just a little more traditional. and which turns out it's not traditional at all. History shows, you know, communities taking care of their dying in a, such a different way. And this is not to poo-poo funeral homes or anything. Like, we've had such great funeral homes in the Athens area that are wanting to be involved and wanting to be able to share that there are options for people. But the fact is, like, you have to go into that knowing that there's options. So something I would love to change is asking questions. What is available for me? Or is this something that you guys can do? I think helping people understand that there are options and that they can make this the way they want it to, this experience, the way they want it and the way they envision, I think is kind of empowering for people.
Now, let's turn to some of your more community-facing work. Can you give us an overview of Death Over Drafts?
The Death Over Drafts was created to be a little bit more of a casual community event, and it was developed by a death doula, Stephanie Elkins, in California. And she wanted to create a community event that was, like I said, a little more casual, a little more fun, and that it sparked connection and encourages, you know, this movement towards destigmatizing conversations. We try to split it up towards some smaller groups because people that are coming into it are a little more they're just nervous. If you're not comfortable with the subject, people are coming in and they might be a little nervous to sit in a big group and share about their thoughts on death and dying. So the structure is really nice. We get to mingle a little bit and meet people, and we play through this very awesome tool that was created by a social worker. Her name's Lisa Powell. It's called the Death Deck, and it has, it's like a deck of playing cards, but it has questions on it. And so the questions vary in kind of the level of seriousness, I guess you would say, about death and dying. And some offer like an ABC option, some offer like a question, and then it's open-ended. And then this just encourages conversation, you know, in the small group.
You talked about grief, you talked about differing levels of seriousness. What's kind of the vibe at Death Over Drafts here in Athens?
We just have such a good time. I hear laughter. I see people crying. I have felt goosebumps throughout my entire body, you know, just listening to people process stuff or share something that, like, you don't normally share.
Jessica Dukes, thank you so much for taking a moment to speak with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for reaching out.
Jessica Dukes is an end-of-life doula in the Athens area. She organizes the monthly discussion group, Death Over Drafts, at Authentic Brewery. To find out exactly what people talk about at Death Over Drafts, WUGA's Emma Auer stopped by the event. Here's her audio postcard, originally broadcast last October.
There is a lot of fear around what's happening with death. There's a lot of, what am I going to do, certain ways to die, and all this different. There was just a lot of fear around it. Now there's a lot less fear. As we talk about it more, it's as natural as being born.
If you were to pass away today, who would be responsible for taking over your stuff? And so I just thought about, you know, like, my parents would be responsible, my family. And the average bereavement from work is 3 to 5 days, which is just not enough time.
My parents have passed a long time ago, executor of their will. I had to do all that stuff, so I've seen all the clutter and all the fights and everything that happens over petty things.
Mm-hmm. I'm a philosophy professor. One of my areas of research is bioethics, and specifically I do a lot of work surrounding medical assistance in dying. Like with most things, it involves having a discussion around people's attitudes and their hesitance and concerns that people have, which I think are justified.
I feel like, especially in the South, it's such a taboo topic nobody really wants to talk about. Particularly like with my family, it's like we talk about death. I've experienced the passing of family members, but I wasn't allowed to like go to funerals until I reached a certain age. But also along with like when somebody dies, there's so much you have to worry about.
I've been talking a little bit about everything, but I had a near-death experience 3 years ago. Completely changed my life and how I look at things and how I help people.
This is something all of us are guaranteed, and I think it's important for us to think about how we want that to go, both in the process and then, of course, after we die, how we want to be remembered, how we want, you know, what we want people to do with our things, our belongings, and how we want our loved ones to be cared for. If we don't talk about death, we're never gonna get clarity on those things.
You just heard the voices of Brian Riccardi, Iris Hector, and Jeremy Davis, who attended September's Death Over Drafts event hosted by local end-of-life doula Jess Dukes. More information can be found at organizingdeath.com. Their voices were set over the sounds of Athens's Good Dirt Old String Band, directed by Rob Sutherland. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. This week's show was produced by Emma Auer. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org. And will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks for listening and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.